It's Thursday, the 28th of August. I'm Alec Hogg. Here's your BizNews briefing. In today's briefing, Mouton's 7 billion rand gift to South Africa. Celia Brink exposes more Tshwane corruption. And more Danelle chickens are coming home to roost. We've got a double feature on how citizens in different countries are protecting their wealth in these uncertain times, gold and Bitcoin. And something that you might chuckle at or perhaps grit your teeth, the Kiwis really fancy their chances of beating the Boca this weekend. But we kick off appropriately with the big news of the last 24 hours. The Boere Buffett, Jannie Mouton, is giving a legacy of 7.2 billion rand to South Africa, but not just the money. He is buying the company that he helped to start, the private schools business, 189 schools, called Curo, out of the holdings of shareholders and selling it back for 1 rand. So effectively, this is a gift, but it's a way of leveraging aggressively the Jannie Mouton Foundation's legacy to the future of South Africa. I've had feedback from Piet Mouton, who is of Jannie's three children, the one who picked up the mantle of driving the PSG business home. And after Jannie retired 7 years ago in that shock announcement, you might recall, where he said he had the early signs of dementia. And Piet says that, well, let's hope it goes through. My view on that is that anybody who stands against the deal actually happening is going to need their heads read, because there will be such righteous indignation to this extraordinary gift to the South African public. I spoke yesterday to Jan Mouton, who is the actuary in the family and the son who is a portfolio manager. And he is also the deputy chairman of the Jannie Mouton Foundation and the man whose idea this all was. And I asked him, how did he and his siblings feel about, well, effectively giving away such a huge bounty that, as the heirs, they, I suppose, would have stood in line to inherit?
No, they were also, Piet immediately said, whoa, this is fantastic idea. Let's get in the car and go and speak to Jannie. So a charity who mostly focus herself on philanthropy efforts, was also from the start very, very happy with this idea. And I think our father raised us the right way. It's a wonderful initiative of his, the Jannie Mouton Foundation. And I think it's a great thing that we now, as the next generation, taking forward his ideas, and that we have found this big opportunity, a focused opportunity. He loved focus and doing things big, and to do it in his lifetime. It's much better to have 189 schools that you fund it for the public than having a share portfolio worth 7.2 billion. So that's in essence what's happening. We're swapping that share portfolio of the foundation for the 189 schools, which are effectively run. They are profitable. There are good systems in place. So, it is a great opportunity for preserving his legacy. And it's a beautiful way. He was inspired by Warren Buffett to give away a portion of his wealth. And we were very, very happy and supportive of him. We're very, very proud of it.
And what did? How did he react when you did get to talk to him about this?
Yes, no, he thought that's like the most greatest idea, and not easy executing these big transactions. It's a lot of legal work, a lot of documents you have to read through. But we got to work, and we've announced the firm intention. Shareholders are getting a 60% premium, so hopefully they'll vote in favor of this transaction. So, and it's not a competitor. For Kiro, it is a friendly party partnering with them to go forward as a public benefit organization. And it's of all the listed businesses, only I think a school would classify as a public benefit activity. You can't have another type of business. They're usually not public benefit activities in the public benefit organization. Can only do certain types of activities to be registered as a public benefit organization. So it was this almost once in a lifetime opportunity, and to do something really big and good. And as far as we can see, it's the biggest donation in South Africa's history to date.
Extraordinary that. So what's going to happen is that the Kiro schools are now no longer needing to service shareholders. They will be owned by the organization itself, and all profits will then be reinvested in expanding and in a way getting more of the young South Africans to be able to participate at Kiro schools. At the moment, there are more than 70,000 pupils in that organization that Jannie Mouton helped to start. Wow, what a legacy. Well, not such good news from another guy in the spotlight at the moment, Celia Brunk, who was the mayor of Tshwane. He was then ousted when Action SA swapped sides, went into bed with the ANC rather than supporting the DA that it had actually co-governed the city with. Lots of funny things happening. Celia Brunk on the DA's podcast took the veil off some pretty worrying issues. He is standing as the next mayor for the DA in the forthcoming local elections.
I've just read up on Tshwane's budget for last financial year that was probably passed in this beginning of this year. Increase in water tanker spending, increase in security tendering or contracts. What's the obsession there with water tankers and securities?
So those are typically the ANC-connected businesses. You know, not great barriers to entry, so you don't need. You just need some muscle on the ground, and then you can run those businesses.
Sure.
And it's a controversial statement to make. You know, DA podcast disclaimer. But it is a business that is rife for corruption, security, waste collection, water tankering. And in the adjustment budget, after they'd removed us at the end of last year, the adjustments budget happens in February. They increase spending on water tankers by 64%. Despite the promise of Hammans Kraal giving people water in their taps instead of tankers. So they budget for failure, essentially. They increase spending on security companies, and it's not technology, it's not state-of-the-art stuff that, you know, J.P. Smith is pioneering here in Cape Town. This is like stationary guards. They call it watchman services.
Wow.
They increase spending on that by 103%.
Ridiculous.
And I mean, we went through a strike the year before, and we didn't even spend that money despite disruptions that you had people smashing water pipes and closing valves. You had attacks on municipal offices and depots. We didn't even spend that money, that kind of money on security companies and water tankers. So what is going on here?
Just join the dots. Quite simple, isn't it?
Robertson, a small town in the middle of nowhere where a wine farmer claims to have sold a Volkswagen up to e-buy cars.
A farmer?
What car did you really sell them?
A VW.
Right here in Robertson?
Small town, but
We know about We Buy Cars.
Yeah, but what's a farmer doing with a VW app?
It was just a runaround.
Cool cover story. And I see you traded it in for this, like a double cab Danay. Were they all out of Rangers?
We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
It was the late Pravin Gordhan who told us to join the dots. And my goodness, there are many of them that we can be joining in this country of ours. Another one comes from the example, a very bad one, set by Danel. You might recall that Danel was one of those state-owned enterprises, as was Eskom, as were others, that was taken over by the Guptas during the Zupta era. Well, we're still paying for that. This morning, my colleague Chris Steyn spoke to the DA spokesperson on defense, Chris Hutting, about how Danel is having to pick up the tab for awful mismanagement and blatant corruption. Let's have a listen.
In 2017, Draken, a company in the United States, entered into a contract with Danel. The core of this contract is that Draken contracted Danel to provide 12 Chicos aircraft to Draken. The total value of the contract was still is $35.2 million. And then Danel demanded to be paid $12.7 million. Which was paid by Draken to Danel. And then the Danel on the airport should have prepared the Cheetos, get them airworthy, and then deliver them to Draken in the United States. Danel only succeeded to deliver 3 of the Cheetos with 9 still outstanding. Now, a lot has changed since then. Danel cannot deliver. The Draken's appetite for this 1970s technology aircraft has dwindled because the U.S. AD program, where they use adversary aircraft to test and train the pilots, is not there, and they've cancelled the contract with Draken. So we sit in a situation where Draken out claims $7.1 million US dollars, and that is the refund of advances paid to Danel, plus damages. This was filed in the United States on the 19th of August, and a summons was issued on the 21st of August. And now Danel says they will oppose this application of a Draken in the United States courts.
Now, is there any point even in suing Danel? Can it make good either way?
Yeah, well, it is one of the many failed state-owned companies. But there is still some value within Danel. But I think what is most at stake here is the continuation of the downgrading in the international mindset of Danel as being a company that cannot deliver. Remember that before State Catchers actually got their greedy hands on Danel, 2015, it was a top company. It manufactured a lot. It actually fulfilled their contractual obligations to the international arms community. And they were an original equipment manufacturer of note in the world. There's still a lot of the technology in the Danel left of the state capture and other things, but it has also lost lots of the capability where the IP is still with Danel and the natural property, but many of the people involved in Danel now are actually working in India and in the Middle East. So Danel has actually become hollowed out, and it is a serious problem. I don't believe that Danel can deliver on this. The U.S. courts will not listen to sob stories about COVID, and other stuff. There's a valid contract. Danelle didn't deliver and are standing naked in the U.S. courts.
And that court case is proceeding at the moment. But just join the dots there. So this is a U.S. company. It commissions Danelle to produce 12 aircraft. Danelle demands that it gets paid a deposit. It's not unusual in business. But then only delivers 3 of the 12. So the deposit hasn't even covered the aircraft that it has delivered. It's just, well, sorry, the deposit is far bigger than the aircraft that were delivered. So now it owes $7 million. But where's that $7 million? And yet the people running Danelle go and fight this in the U.S. courts, adding more and more to the costs of South African taxpayers. The mind boggles. Surely we are due better governors than this bunch that we seem to be having. And that's a feeling that's going on all around the world. We're noticing that citizens are getting more and more agitated. And we'll bring you two clips now, one from the latest Mining Web Weekly, where I talk with Peter Major. He is an expert on mining, a veteran in the field. And man, what Major's forgotten, the rest of us still have to know or have to learn about mining. And I asked him about the surge in the gold price and what was behind it. And the reason that this is relevant is that the gold price has been on a run reminiscent of what happened in the 1970s. Never before have we seen this kind of boom. Here's Peter's insights.
Demand. Broader demand than we've ever seen. Broader demand from the central banks than we have ever seen. And remember, the central bank buying in the 70s, how different the world is today. You know, did China even have a central bank in the 70s? Oh boy, they got a central bank now. It's as big as the American central bank. Now, the American central bank isn't buying gold, but the Chinese central bank is. And I think there was a graph that David Melville sent out this morning. You probably saw it, Alec. It shows gold is now the second largest foreign exchange holding in the world's central banks. 20% is gold. Remember the Swiss always used to recommend, or supposedly the Swiss recommended you have 5%, you know, in case there's a revolution and you got to get out of town quick. Well, now central bank holdings, 20% of gold. It's, was it 40% in dollars? I didn't even look at the others. But yeah, it is massive, constant central bank buying. The central banks are larger than ever. They're more aggressive than ever. And we just hear the populace. We know the populace in America is buying like they haven't bought since the 70s. Now I hear the populace in China, 1.4 billion people is buying. And that's a free country. And those people have spending power. You know, China is so different. So there's not many comparisons we can do with the 70s that hold water here.
Fascinating podcast. If you are interested in mining or indeed in finding a alternative investment opportunity, most of us look at tech and industry. Peter's really such an expert, and the Mining Web Weekly podcast is very, very well worth listening. It's on the BizNews TV channel on YouTube. Well, now moving on to another area. Gold has been a source of value for centuries, but more recently, a digital source of value has come into play in Bitcoin. Now, we know that Bitcoin is the currency of choice for many people in the underworld, but it's also become more and more popular in countries which are going through very difficult times. And if you were to have a list of those in the world, the one topping them is unquestionably Venezuela, where things have really, really gone awry. We are indebted to our partners at the Financial Times for this insight, where the host of the FT news briefing, Mark Filippino, enlightened us on the story in today's episode of that podcast.
Cryptocurrencies are transforming Venezuela. People are flocking to them as an alternative because the country's currency is flailing. But is crypto a serious challenger to the Bolivar? Here with me to discuss is the FT's Joe Daniels, who's been covering this. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Mark.
So where are we seeing cryptocurrency usage crop up around Venezuela?
Well, we're seeing it crop up everywhere. It's used in neighborhood stores. It's used in retail chains. It's used by some people to pay rent. It's used for all sorts of transactions in the country. Chainalysis, a firm that monitors crypto uptake, says it surged 110% in the last year that they have data for.
Wow, that's insane. So what is behind the surge, Joe?
Well, driving the surge is economic instability in Venezuela, which is one of the most distorted economies in the world. Venezuela has a highly authoritarian government that has instigated kind of socialist policies, which have completely distorted and warped the economy with price controls and currency controls. And that it's dealt with hyperinflation in the last decade. As a result, people don't have faith in the currency. I mean, the Bolivar currency has lost 70% of its value between October and June this year. People are just desperate for some kind of currency that is much more usable, much more fungible than the Bolivar. So we've seen an uptake in dollars, and crypto is kind of a natural development of that, because getting a hold of physical dollars in cash in Venezuela is not that easy.
It sounds like there aren't a lot of options here for people, and that's why they're turning to crypto. How does the government feel about crypto?
Well, the government has had a checkered history over crypto. First off, they'd floated the idea of launching their own kind of oil-backed cryptocurrency called the Petro. It went nowhere. They have a crypto regulating body, which is currently being investigated by Venezuelan authorities over corruption within a system that is widely regarded as corrupt. So the government's attitude on crypto has kind of shifted quite a bit, both in terms of promoting cryptocurrencies and then cracking down and saying that they are a method for corruption within the government. It poses challenges to the economy. You have a shadow currency being widely used. You have more transactions taking place outside of regulators' oversight.
Joe Daniels covers South America for the FT. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Mark.
Remember that story when you next hear a local politician telling you how wonderful Venezuela's system of government is. Well, let's move on to global markets now. And in many ways, investors have been holding off from taking big bets one way or the other ahead of financial results from NVIDIA. NVIDIA is the giant of artificial intelligence. It makes most of the AI chips, and it released its results after the close of the US markets yesterday. This morning, the Bloomberg team in Asia gave their insights into how the market reacted to NVIDIA.
Paul, the thing we can't ignore, of course, is the NVIDIA earnings. I say that, but the after-hours move wasn't huge. NASDAQ futures actually pairing earlier losses as we get closer to the European open here. So how do you put the NVIDIA story in context for us?
Yeah, good morning, Anna. I think, yeah, it's a really interesting question and way to look at it is the idea that Asia's markets really didn't respond all that much at all to what we saw with NVIDIA. Remember, we build this as a really big risk event. Implied volatility was suggesting there could be really major swings either way based on what the earnings showed. And indeed, it did drop quite a long way, around 3% in after hours trading in the US. But the knock-on impact for broader markets doesn't seem to have been all of that great. I think there's a couple of things to think about. One, the earnings really weren't all that bad. There's some uncertainties in there, and that's part of what made them look a little bit weaker, the fact that they excluded China from there altogether. And two, even then, The size of their earnings is still pretty phenomenal, all else being considered. I think that Asia's markets had an extra fillip because NVIDIA is a bit worried about what it can do in China. That is opening space for the Chinese technology companies to also come in. And so they had another good day. But all in all, the market was happy enough with that and focusing on other things.
Yeah, well, that's NVIDIA's story. Coming back here to the South African markets, where we had some big company results released on the Stock Exchange News Service this morning. Let's kick off with Rainbow Chicken. Don't you love that picture? That's from the front page of the latest annual report. Resilient numbers, and that is as a consequence of a turnaround strategy that's been going on at Rainbow Chicken now for a while. The share price up 20% in the past year. Revenues up 9% in these results for the 12 months to the end of June, but operating profit up 66%, and then trebling of headline earnings per share, and so a dividend of 20 cents was declared. However, it's not without issues. Looking ahead, the management team at Rainbow are worried about Trump tariffs, and they pointed out how they're being hurt by an inefficient Transnet. Isn't that just a theme of the company results recently? Impala Platinum, one of the biggest platinum producers in the world, it's had a fantastic movement in the share price, up 87% in the past year. And this morning it released results for the year to end June. They have refocused their cash flows, focusing on cash flows, cut capital expenditure by half, well, 50%, and which is half. And as a result of that, strong cash flows and a final dividend of 165 cents a share was declared. Unusual that, because headline earnings per share, which is usually, you usually pay your dividend out of headline earnings per share, that was half of the dividend that they paid. But they are now focusing more on cash flows as a way of rewarding shareholders. On the downside, production fell 3%, sales down 2%, and there were setbacks in Zimplats in Zimbabwe and in Impala Platinum Canada. Also, eight fatalities were reported, which just highlights how dangerous it is to be a miner. Similarly, at Harmony Gold, although there were good numbers financially, they had 10 fatalities in the financial year to the end of June 2025. Shareholders are happy, though, 27% increase in the average gold price, and that came with a slight improvement in underground grades. What that means is that the rock that they're mining has got a little bit more gold than it had in the previous year. Headline earnings per share were up 26%, and they've made their biggest ever distribution of dividends during this financial year. The balance sheet was also strengthened, which is a good thing, given that they are about to diversify. And Harmony Gold's probably going to have to be called Harmony Gold and Copper in future, moving into copper. Bad news, gold production down another 5% in this period, and all-in costs out of kilter with the other gold miners who have reported. That was up by 17%. Well, before we leave you, we need to have a look at what's going to be happening in the rugby, and in particular, the way the Kiwis are geeing up their population to give the Springboks quite a few boos and hopefully the All Blacks a winning edge in the test, a couple of tests that are coming up in the next fortnight. Let's have a look at how the advert that is flighting all over New Zealand at the moment.
How's it?
Hey, brother.
I'm just here for a quick cut before the box run riot this weekend.
You don't bark, eh?
And we'll beat you anyway.
World champs are coming. And the All Blacks,
they'll be like little lambs on a braai.
All done, champ.
Thank you.
Love the fade, bird. The rugby championship.
well, we'll see who laughs last on that one, but what a great rivalry. This has been your briefing for today. Look forward to being back with you on Monday, where Bronwyn Nielsen will be in the hot seat. Until then, cheerio.